Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch movies we probably should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Joining me once more is none other than Mr. John Mills. John, welcome. Welcome to the show.
It's Missing Frames. It's a sequel, and it's a movie I've never seen. Bam, I had to show up. Come on now.
And this is, again, I mean, the levels of excitement are off the charts because
yes.
We're concluding our Before trilogy. I mean,
yeah.
This is kind of crazy. And what's even crazier is that it's been a year since we first watched Before Sunrise.
That is crazy. I lived in another state when we watched Before Sunrise.
How weird is that? You're
right.
We're both in completely different states, not just states of mind, but literal actual states.
Yeah.
And
wow.
Everything's changed.
Yeah. Everything has changed. I forgot that too. Wow, that a lot has changed. But what I can say is that I still remember seeing that. I remember that night watching it and just how like everything just changed in terms of like I fell in love with that film. Absolute love with that film.
Yeah, that was great. And I which again, if you haven't listened to it already, you should go back and listen to Before Sunrise and Before Sunset and then get on this episode. Come back.
Yes.
We'll still be here. It's totally fine. We won't judge you. But I remember how nervous I was about you watching it because I didn't know how you were going to react. And I didn't know if it was going to really, you know, it's a tough movie for some people to watch and some people don't fall along its wavelength. So just being able to experience that with you and to have that experience, something I really hold dear, and I like to revisit that from time to time because I just like hearing the sound of my own voice. Okay, I'll be honest.
Hey, you know, I enjoy revisiting it in my head at least. No, but I've listened to that episode, you know, because it's weird, and you know, so long as we're talking about the episode, it's weird because it's a joyous experience to hear the conversation that we had, specifically because I like to be reminded of exactly how much joy that film gave me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I have since, it's funny because you know, I used to give you a fair amount of guff, as the kids say, about your Linklater, you know, fandom and everything. It's like, rah, 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 rah. Oh, what do you know? I didn't like Dazed and Confused. And now I've like,
that's a pretty
Boyhood.
Good impression of yourself, actually.
John,
you do a pretty mean impression of John.
Evil John. I'm from the Mirror Universe. but, you know, it's interesting, too, now having gone and seen Boyhood. And being able to recognize, like, oh, well, they were doing this while they were doing, you know, like, seeing the time periods, like, matching up and stuff like that. And as soon as you said, well, hey, we got to do, you know, Before Midnight. And I suddenly realized, I think I've now had, I guess, in miniature, the reaction that people who were fans of Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, that waiting. And forgetting and just saying, oh, you know, like it's sort of like gone in the back of my mind and it's a pleasant memory that I had. And then you're like, Before Midnight, I'm like, oh, that's right. That's right. There's a third one, which I guess must have been the reaction that, you know, when they were like, we're going to make the third one.
Right.
Everybody must have been like,
well,
wow.
It's funny because we've spaced these out. You know, it hasn't been 9 years. Sadly, as much as John and I wanted to do a 9-year thing, it just wasn't feasible. But we did met. I mean, this is basically every 6 months we've watched one of these. So it's been a consistent amount of time. I'm a little sad. I'm not going to lie. I'm a little bummed. We're going to have to wait. If they do decide to make more, we're going to have to wait at least 4 more years before we get it, if they're going to do another 9 years after Before Midnight. But it's funny to talk about Before Midnight and how, like, what it was like to anticipate it and to wait for it, because Before Midnight was the first one that I was in that fan base. I had seen Before Sunrise and Before Sunset in 2000 2007, early 2007. And at that point, I was like, this is it. I guess we're done. And, you know, maybe there will be another one. There were little rumblings, but no one was even confirming anything. And I remember it was 2012 when all of a sudden someone, a friend of mine who was also a fan of the movie, said, oh, like, Richard Linklater is filming a movie with the initials BM, and it's got to be before something. What is it? And people were like, you know, theorizing. It's like, it's funny that these movies can inspire that kind of devotion where it's like, oh, what's the next Star Wars movie going to be called? What's it going to, that was what it was like. It was like, oh, what's the next before movie? Is it a before movie? It's gotta be. It's only two words. It's two initials. It's gotta be. And then when they announced it, it was like, it wasn't just we're going to, it was, we already filmed it and it's coming out in 2013. And it was like, oh my God. And they had a still of Jesse and Celine. And it was like, oh my God, this is really happening. And it was such a surreal experience for me to, it's akin to, I don't know, it's hard to explain that kind of reaction. It's akin to like when a band you love makes a new album, I guess, after a few years hiatus and you don't know if they're coming back, and then out of nowhere they're like, we have a new album, and you're like, oh my God, am I gonna like, I guess I have to like this is my favorite band. And it was a very strange experience to suddenly be looking at this movie through other people's eyes, to realize how much time had passed since the last one, to like acknowledge like, oh my God, it's been 9 years since 2004. But even weirder is the fact that it was 2013, which means you and I had just met.
My gosh, that's right.
Yeah. So
yeah,
when you and I had started working together, I had just found out about Before Midnight. So how insane. It's been a year since we did Before Sunrise, and it's been almost 5 years since we met and since this movie was released. But I can just imagine me going into your office and telling you, oh, hey, I'm going to be going to New York to go see this movie Before Midnight, and you saying, who are you? Get out of my office. But I remember probably
at that, was I still in, who's the weird kid? Is he a threat to my job phase?
Yes, I think you were. So this, because this was only, I'd only been there for about a month at this point. So
oh yeah, no, definitely. Because you were working in somebody else's office. I'd see you at the table in their office every so often. I was like, who the hell is that?
Right. Yes. So I thought, when I realized that, I was like, this is okay. What can we talk about in the before show? I realized, oh my God, we had met when I was going to go see Before Midnight.
It's our own, we're Jesse and Celine all over again. That's how that works.
That nothing has filled me with more terror than those words in my entire life.
That's why you wake up in the middle of the night with flop sweats.
Speaking of flop sweats, no, I don't know how to transition out of that, but I did want to plug the Nerd Party a little bit before we get a little bit too excited. I feel like I'm already going off about how much this movie has affected me, but I'll plug the Nerd Party a little bit. The Nerd Party basically is the network that Missing Frames is a part of. Tons of great podcasts. You can follow the Nerd Party at Join Nerd Party. You can like us on Facebook at the Nerd Party. And then, John, you have a couple other shows. Why don't you talk to the good people at home about those shows?
Well, gosh, you can listen to me here on the Nerd Party on a regular basis as part of the Parsec award-winning Aggressive Negotiations that looks at the deeper aspects of the Star Wars galaxy. And you can hear me on Great Shot Kid, analyzing film and filmmakers with Mike Schindler. And that's where you can find me here on the Nerd Party. And every so often, I drag Sean on for a guest over on Words with Nerds for a delightful romp of comedy.
And it's been way too long, and I would love to come back. Craig, I know you're not listening, but somehow I feel like you'll feel a disturbance in the force, and you'll feel my desire to come back. We've got to complete that James Bond retrospective. Oh,
yes, we really need to. Living Daylights is the next one, baby. You know I want to talk about it.
It'll happen. Yes. But bringing it back to 2013, you know, we had met at this point, but I just want to bring it back to the weirdness of anticipating this movie and being excited to see this. So I was so pumped for this movie. I actually was like, I knew it was going to be a limited release at first. I knew that it was only going to be in New York and LA. And I was like, I don't care. I'm going to see it opening weekend. And Sarah, my wife, and I, we planned a trip. We got a whole bunch of people together. Some people who had never seen Richie Pepio, who's been on the show before.
Yes.
He'd never seen the first two, but he and his girlfriend at the time, they were like, yeah, sure, we'll go see Before Midnight with you, because they were living in New York. At this point I'd realized that Before Sunrise and Before Sunset meant so much to me, and I think at that point I decided these are my favorite movies. So I was like, I'm going. We're gonna make a trip out of it. We're gonna get people together. We got to hang out with a couple of Sarah's friends who she'd met them over the internet and had never hung out with them before, and we got to go to New Jersey and stay with them, show them Before Sunrise and Before Sunset for the first time, and then the next day we all went and saw Before Midnight together. It was such a surreal experience. But the most surreal thing about it is what I was saying before, and I want to open it up to you, John, to see if there's anything similar in your life that you've experienced. But going to see Before Midnight was such a surreal experience because of the fact that I knew I loved these movies, and I knew this was the only one I was getting for at least another 9 years. So there was, I don't want to say pressure on the movie, like I wasn't going into it like I need this to be the greatest thing ever, but there was a weirdness of like, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset are my favorite movies. Before Midnight has to go up there. It can't just be Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. It automatically gets a free pass to the front of the line to be one of the favorites. That was a very strange realization, going into a movie and knowing that no matter what I was going to see, it was going to have to probably end up ranking with the other two in my mind. And I don't think I ever foresaw a situation where it was going to be like, oh my God, I hate this movie. It's terrible and it ruined my life. But there was a weirdness going into that. And is there, have you experienced that with any other franchise? I know we've talked about Star Wars a lot, and I feel like if that's the franchise we're going to talk about, we should do it.
No, I'm going to pull a head fake on you here, because everybody knows about, you know, episode 3 and, you know, all of that stuff and all of that, which I do love the prequels. So if anybody wants to take a pause and like shout at me, you know, or anything like that, feel free. But
do it. It's so much fun. You'll feel so much better.
It is. I'm the world's emotional punching bag. I'm the emotional punching bag you need. But speaking of that, Dark Knight Rises. There was actual like pit of my stomach, like, oh man, come on, please don't. You don't ever want to go into a beloved franchise and have it disappoint in any way, because you know, as a fan, as a longtime fan, that eventually they'll release The Last Jedi and you have to find a way to make it work into the saga somehow. You have, you know, it may be the child that maybe gets C's instead of B's and A's in school, but you still got to find a way to love them. You got to, they're part of the family. You got to take it easy on them. And so, yeah, like I totally get that. And the thing is, I have a little bit of that. I know you very generously, as we covered on the previous shows, you very generously made the Before trilogy a gift to me so that I would watch them. And I do have this sense of trepidation going into Before Midnight, because Before Sunset literally just knocked my socks off. Like I was stunned that I loved it the way, you know, the same way, but differently. And like, it just, you know, as Before Sunrise. And so now it's like Before Midnight. Like, I think one can be a fluke. Two, once the second one exceeds your expectations, Godfather 2, for instance.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and then, yeah, you hear Godfather Part 3 is coming out and you're like, oh man, guys, please don't tarnish this. Yeah. You please don't do this to me, you know, make this worth it. But yeah, I do have a little bit of that sense here of, I want to love this because I adore the first two.
Right. And that's completely understandable. And going into the movie, it's exactly what I felt amplified. Just going to a movie theater, the fact that it was a trip to New York, the fact that it was like, I'm making all these people, some of whom have no basis for understanding this third film, go see this movie. There was so much just like writing on it. And I have to say, from my perspective, it was like sitting down and the screen coming up and watching this movie. It is the same feeling of delight I felt watching the other two, as far as like, oh my God, my friends are back. Like, this is, it's them. And not only that, it was just weird. Like, I'm in a movie theater. This has never happened before. I've never seen one of these in a theater before. And just having that, that was such a sense of relief. And it was just like one of those things where you haven't seen somebody in a few years and you're like, are we still going to click the same way? And that, that overwhelming rush of like, oh, thank God, this is exactly this is who I remember. We've changed, we've grown, things are a little different, but this is the same. I love them for the same reasons I remember loving them. And what do you know about Before Midnight?
Nothing.
Great. Awesome.
I know about it is that it's a different time of day than either sunrise or sunset.
All you need to know is it takes place 9 years later and it stars Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. I'm not going to tell you anything. With Before Sunset, I felt like I kind of set the stage a little bit and was like, oh, it takes place in real time. It's the flip side of the coin of like, you know, Before Sunrise was the happy, optimistic 20-year-olds in love. Before Sunset was a little bit more of the flip side of like, it's a bit more pessimistic. It's a bit more realistic. They're in their 30s now. You know, obviously, time has passed. They're in their 40s. That's all I'm going to tell you. One of my big regrets of... before I was seeing this movie, going into the marketing and watching the trailers and just like scooping up every possible bit of material I could get because I was so excited, I kind of wish I'd gone into it blind without knowing anything. And I want to give you that experience. And other than that, I wanted to ask, do you have any ideas or thoughts on where Jesse and Celine might be this time around?
Oh, see, the thing is, I hate getting into these guessing games. Mm-hmm. I've come to hate getting into these guessing
games. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I do this a lot on Missing Frames. I will sometimes try to guess, like, oh, this is what the movie's about. I will have the person who is co-hosting with me who hasn't seen the movie, like, explain what they think it's about. It doesn't really work with these, I've noticed.
I will say, though, that given the trajectory, you know, contained within the previous two... And I'm closing my eyes because I don't even want to see. And I'm gonna give you a second. I'm just gonna share it with you. I'm seriously gonna give an extra beat afterward with my eyes closed because I do not want to see your facial reaction.
Okay.
But Before Midnight signifies to me that there's a divorce coming, and they have to, like, midnight is when it goes into effect. So I still have my eyes closed, everyone, and I cannot see Sean's reaction. I have no idea how close
I can confirm that he does indeed have his eyes closed. Yeah. He also can't see that I'm writing down the ending to the film. Everyone is a robot from the future.
It's just like Battlestar Galactica.
So, yeah, I will say this. I think this is a really beautiful kind of heartbreaking tidbit of trivia that I wanted to share. I've been holding off until this episode to share it with you because I think it comes into play as far as coloring some of the themes in this film. And the woman that Richard Linklater met in I think it was 1990, 1989, the woman who inspired Before Sunrise and inspired the series of movies, the woman that he spent a night with just hanging around talking in New York City, or I think it was either New York City or Philadelphia. I'm pretty sure it was Philadelphia. Her name was Amy Lerhaupt. I feel like I'm pronouncing her last name wrong. But they had that connection, and Linklater was even telling her, he's like, I really want to make a movie just about this. And she was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, not about like us, but like about this feeling, this excitement, this joy of connecting with somebody. And Richard Linklater always hoped she might come to a screening of one of these movies. And she never did. He never saw her. And a friend of hers got in contact with him in 2010 and told him that she had been killed in a motorcycle accident.
Oh, no.
And it was 6 weeks before they'd started production on Before Sunrise. And he had no idea. And Before Midnight is dedicated to her. And it's so sad because he talks about how he always hoped she'd come to one of these movies, kind of in a Jesse Celine kind of way, where Celine shows up at the bookstore and Before Sunset. But he found that out about her in 2010, just 2 years before they started production on this film.
Wow.
And it's an interesting tidbit. It's interesting that the film's dedicated to her, and it's a beautiful thing, and so sad, but it's such a beautiful story, and it's incredible. I don't remember the exact quote, but Richard Linklater just talks about, like, you know, he found out about it and it affected him profoundly, but he was also like, it's amazing how people can kind of affect you and shape your life in a way, and you never see them again.
You know, and that's one of the things, and it's like, you know, I hate breaking down and doing any sort of mushy thing, but it's like, that's one of the reasons I think that it's incumbent. You know, like, we all fly off the handle, we all get in bad traffic and everything, but it's like every little interaction you have is going to affect somebody some way. And so what does it cost you to be pleasant to someone? Because you might be that thing that turns their day around, or that they look back on in time and they're like, that was a good day, or, oh, somebody was nice to me today. You know, all right, it's okay.
Right.
You know, I'm going to make it through. Like, it's so fascinating to me too, because Linklater, who I've come to have an extreme appreciation for, I don't know of another filmmaker that has so beautifully captured that feeling of humanity that's there. I mean, there are so many things, especially being a sci-fi fan and a comic book fan, it's all about, you know, oh, you know, our disconnect from each other and our disconnect with because of technology. But these are, all of his films are just resolutely human films.
Mm.
And that in and of itself makes them strangely offbeat in the current cinema space. You know, like, he's almost in a way an echo of the movies that sort of dominated the landscape before the era of, you know, the $200 million blockbuster or the Marvel franchise.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, there's something charming about that.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think we should just break and get to watching this movie.
I'm on board.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. And John, this is very exciting, because I get the sense, even more than with the other two movies, that you are, like, about to explode. Like, there's a moment where we started talking to each other, and it was like, ah, come on, all right, we gotta make this happen. Let's just go record, because I what did you think of Before Midnight? I'm dying to hear your opinion.
Okay, before we get to that,
okay.
I just want to say, watching it, going into it, and then afterward, there was Brad Bird's preface to the making of Return of the Jedi by J.W. Rinzler, the big coffee table book that came out, you know, for the 30th anniversary or whatever. And one of the things he wrote about was, you know, there are people who disagreed with how it ended. There are people who are highly critical, but how can you possibly please everybody with the ending of a trilogy, because everybody's got their expectations. They think of where the story's going to go. They think of this, they think of that. And the only thing that I could think afterwards was, well, I don't know how, but Linklater did it with this one. because what I said to you was, one of the things that just threw me for a loop through Before Midnight was, I still hadn't realized how emotionally invested in these characters I was and am. I was physically uncomfortable during their fight. I was like, I wanted to go and be like, knock it off, can't you two crazy kids see that you love each other?
I know. And it's so funny, because Julie Delpy, during the writing process, she kept saying, especially I think when they were writing that fight, she would stop and say, guys, can't they just walk around and talk with each other again like we did in the other two?
Yeah. But that's the thing, is it's so real. And it starts, okay, look, we're already at the fight. That's a significant portion.
Yeah, we're in spoiler
territory. Into the film.
So just get used to it.
Well, I don't think really the fight, saying that there's a fight spoils anything. You see it brewing. And that's the That is one of the most uncomfortable brilliances of the film, is it starts, the whole fight really starts in the first scene.
Mm.
And it just boils over in that one scene. But you can tell through the whole thing, what I find truly brilliant about the whole thing is after before sunrise and before sunset, you got your happily ever after.
Mm.
And then with this one, the whole premise is happily ever after is more complicated than you think it is.
Yeah. And that's what I always, you know, I part of me sympathizes with Julie Delpy. And I'm sure Linklater and Hawke felt the same way. Like, oh, do we really want to do this? But it is the only, feels like the only thing they could have done. Feels like the right thing to do. And it feels, more importantly, it feels like the responsible thing to do. Because these movies have never been anything less than 100% authentic and real and sincere in their emotions. And to imply that any relationship, even the most ideal, wonderful, and amazing relationship, would go off without a hitch and would everything would be perfect and wonderful is just not a reality. And with any relationship, no matter how much you love each other, you're going to have moments where you are going to have to, like, just go out, like, just go at each other. And it's funny because I talked to a couple people. It's weird. So actually, one of our old coworkers, do you remember Rebecca from our
work? Of course I do. Yes.
I'd been talking about this movie. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so excited. And she went and saw it with her now husband, her fiance at the time, and she hadn't seen the first two movies. Yeah, and same with my good friend Richie, who's been on the show, and he enjoyed it. But it's like, to me, I kept telling them, I was like, you don't do that. You don't go to see The Return of the King before you see Fellowship of the Ring and Two Towers. Like, you need the story. You need to know who these people are, I feel like. And I that was tough because I remember she said this movie was so depressing. It was so sad, and they clearly hate each other. And I was like, wait. I don't think they hate each other. I think the idea of conflict, even as painful as it is here, being like a negative thing, to me, and one of the things I think Linklater and the rest of the group also said, is the important thing is that they're still communicating with each other and they haven't shut each other out. They're still trying to understand and work with each other despite the differences.
Yeah. I actually think while you're talking about that, about, you know, in theater classes and stuff like that, they would always say, imagine there's a rope between you and the other character that you have conflict with. Why don't they just walk away? What is that rope made of? Mm. Why are you guys tied together? They would even have acting exercises sometimes where you would, like, literally attach yourself to the other actor and stuff like that. It was weird. But in terms of depressing, I think this is a film you can come in and see cold. I wouldn't recommend it because, of course, there's so much history to these characters, and you're way more invested in this if you've seen the first two. But what I think one of the great things about it is it takes that time, just like Before Sunset did, of reestablishing who these people are and who they are in relation to each other. And I would not categorize this as depressing so much as, I mean, honestly, hopeful, because, and again, spoiler territory, guys, if you haven't seen Before Midnight, sorry, but the simple fact that it doesn't end the way you think it's going to end after that giant fight. You're conditioned by films to believe, oh, if you have a fight like that, we're going Kramer versus Kramer. Michael and Kay are breaking up. We're all done. Everybody's separating. But this shows the reality of it, that sometimes you can say some of the harshest, not to make a big joke out of it, but to make a big joke out of it. I always think of Kramer's bit from Seinfeld where he's like, it's like being in prison. You wake up, she's there. You go to eat, she's there. And I mean, you know, and that can get to both parties. And so it winds up actually, I think, on a very hopeful note, because it's a recognition. And I mean, he encapsulates it so perfectly where he's like, this isn't a fairy tale. This is, you know, did you hear what I said back in the hotel room? I did, but I didn't think you meant it.
Yeah.
You know, like that ability to overcome those terrible moments is what makes a relationship magical.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
I mean, again, I can't compliment them enough because this is not, it is not the easiest thing to do. When you're talking about a romantic film, like you said, convention says, it's like, this movie is like, spoiler alert for those who are not aware of this 20, 30-year-old TV show. when what are their names? Diane and Sam from Cheers get together. And then the audience is kind of like, ah, we're not interested anymore. You want that longing. You need like, oh, I want them to pine for each other. I want, when you finally get what you want, it's almost like, ah, I don't care. That is the hardest thing to do. When you have a romance where your two, like the two leads are together and they're together for the duration of the movie where there's nothing they are necessarily like striving for. There's no unrequited love. There's no like, we need to figure out how we feel about each other. We need to experience everything. This is, they've been together for 9 years and they are on the flip side of all the positive emotion. Now it's become routine for them. Now it's become life. It's become the standard for them. They're no longer each other's escape. They are the thing that they feel they might need to escape from. And that's a really tough thing to do. And like, the fact that they devoted themselves to doing that, to saying this is the direction we're going to go in and we're just going to like, let's do it. I mean, that is that, like, you know, every single one of these movies is impressive in its own way. But Before Midnight is almost like a whole other level of accomplishment. To take one of these great on-screen romances that you love these people, you love their love for each other, and then to kind of make them sort of enemies for a good chunk of the movie, that's insane.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, layered on top of that is this beautiful subtext to the hotel room in the first place. Is it's never directly said, but there's very much this undertone because, of course, everybody's talking about the nature of relationships and long-term relationships. There's that big discussion at the dinner table, and you see the tension between Jesse and Celine. And it's not brand new. That you can tell that this is something that's been simmering for a while.
Right.
And they initially try to give that hotel room back. And there's very much, I think it's very subtly and very beautifully played of the couple that's giving, Ariadne and
Stefanos.
Yeah. Saying, no, we'd be offended. We can't get a, this is another couple recognizing that they need to have a moment, whether it's a fight, whether it's a romantic night. They need a minute away to reestablish whatever's going to happen in their lives.
Right.
And I think that's just such a beautiful, because that is another thing that is gorgeous and speaks to the fact that your relationship with the other person doesn't even just involve you two. It involves the world around you.
Right.
And there are people who want you to stay together or what have you.
I wanted to ask you about that scene in particular, because this movie contains a lot of firsts for the series. We get the first actual score in a movie, in a before movie. Like there's an actual soundtrack. This is a new cinematographer. So there's kind of a similar feel as far as it's still the walk and talk format, but there is kind of a unique visual sense to this movie that is different and sets it apart, I feel, from the other two. But also, this is the first time where, like you said, the reality of being in a serious relationship and being with someone for a long time is you're no longer in isolation. You are now part of a world of people. Like, you're going to have that support system around you. And I was going to ask, how did that feel to you? That there's an extended scene about the pretty much the second act of this movie is an extended, like, 20-minute scene of them dining with other people. And, it's fascinating because each of the people they are dining with represent different kinds of relationships. You have the two young kids who kind of are Jesse and Celine when they first met. You have Stefanos and his wife who are kind of almost over the hump in a way. Like, you feel like they've had their Jesse and Celine hotel moment and they've kind of cleared it. And then you have the elderly couple, and they've both had their own relationships where you have the man who talks about, you know, the one who invited everyone out to his place in Greece in the first place. He talks about how, you know, he and his wife, what their relationship was like. And then this woman, I don't want to talk about this yet because I think this is a big point I want to ask you about. But then you have the other woman who doesn't say anything. And then at the end kind of blasts you with this very profound statement. But how did you, was it a weird feeling watching Jesse and Celine having such extensive interactions where they are not the focus?
Yeah, but what I think it also signifies is absolutely right. Their world is larger. Once you're in a relationship, there's more people around you, but there were other people they interact with through the course of the previous two films, but they all fleetingly move through their day and
right.
representationally through their lives. And it's the permanence of these people. And switching the focus, I think, is, I mean, it's not switching the focus, but expanding the focus, I think, threw me a little bit at the beginning of it. But once I got into that groove of realizing, I see what we're doing here, is we're showing comparison contrast. We're seeing how Jesse and Celine interact with each other in comparison to these other three couples that are around them. We get to see how their dynamic is different. So it's not just this jarring, abstract, oh, they're having a rough time and this is them. It's they're having a rough time, but I've seen them behave like that young couple. And I imagined they'd be serene like the old couple, or at the very least, you know, nice and calm like the couple that's of similar age. And so I think it's a very excellent way to, you know, show that comparison contrast and to build their specific, not leave it just to them, basically, to build what's going on in their lives.
Right. There's you this know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, you know, after this certain point, I think that the true, you know, bravery isn't the right word, but the truly great thing, the true reversal of an expectation, is that they don't use the kids as a way to demonstrate what their life is about. The kids are there. We know the kids are there. We know they have a relationship with the children, but they're not the focus of, you know, again, it's another movie trope. We expect the big argument and everybody breaks up. Or we expect the couple is married and they have their kids, and so the kids are always there in the scene, and that serves as the trigger for the fight. And instead, it still treats Jesse and Celine as their own people, you know, within this context.
Right. And there's this moment that kind of rips my heart out when I watch that scene where one particular moment is, I think, the young couple. I can't remember who it is. I'm almost positive it's the younger couple when they talk about they're like, yeah, you know, we're realistic. We know that, like, the idea of true love and soulmates doesn't really exist. And we know, we recognize.
Oh, yeah.
And it cuts to Jesse and Celine, and you see it in their faces that they believed it.
Right.
That's why they're together, because they thought they could do it. And they are struggling so much. And it's such a heart-wrenching moment because you see it in their faces, how heartbroken they are. Like, it's like,
yeah,
they are almost ashamed of it, like that innocence, that kind of innocent feel of they wanted to, and they believed in love, and they believed they could, like, that their love was gonna, like, it doesn't matter as long as we're together. And just having it kind of thrown in their faces, like, yeah, we know that it's an idea and it's silly and it doesn't last, and seeing their kind of, like, you know, we've spent so much time with, we spent the past two decades listening to them talk about how important love is to them, and how they've connected on a more profound level than what we are used to seeing in any movie. And to just see that moment kind of so debunked so simply, and to see their reactions to it, it's kind of heartbreaking.
Yes, but at the same time, I take it as like, I feel bad for that young couple, because they're, I don't know, you know what, call me a romantic or whatever, but there's got to be that spark. You might not think, oh, it's going to be fairy tale or anything like that, but there's got to be that spark at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's not just a business transaction. If it's just a business transaction,
well,
what's the fun?
You could argue, there is an argument to be made that Before Midnight, even though it has this kind of tone that's very somber. Like, it feels more somber than the other two.
Yeah.
There's an argument to be made, though, that it is the most romantic, because it's that is, like he said, this is real life. This is what love is. And if you can't see that, you're blind, because it's like, it is. It's true. That is 100% true. Before Sunrise and Before Sunset are beautiful and sincere, but it is not a depiction of a real and lasting relationship. It's a depiction of ideas of relationships and two people who have become ideas for each other. And the brave and really, I mean, the really courageous thing that they did is they said, we are going to make the attempt to make this a reality, and we're going to take that for what it is, and we're going to fight to make it happen. And to me, that's almost more romantic than like, oh, it's a one night stand in France, or not in France, in Vienna, or we're, you know, it's a one, it, we have to reunite in France and Paris to find out, are we truly in love? You know, it's not, they've decided to commit to each other for life, and they're struggling, but they're trying.
You know, as corny as this is going to sound, as you were talking, the idea that pops in my head, and this is corny, and I admit it, but in a sense, it's a traditional, it is a traditional fairy tale in Before Midnight, because you have the gallant knight, and you have the princess, and they're there's a rescue. I guess the dragon between them is life.
Yeah.
And they're trying to slay that dragon so that they can be reunited.
Right. I mean,
you know, you could put a fairy tale spin on it. Yeah, it's a stretch. But at the same time, at its core, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the fight. It's the daily fight to make the decision. And I mean, isn't that what really healthy love is? Is you're making a decision to be with somebody.
Yeah.
You're not with them because you're compelled. You're not with them because you view that you have no other idea or opportunity or anything like that. You're with them because you said, hey, I accept this.
Mm.
I accept that, my wife's a saint because I know everything she puts up with. but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's that daily decision. You're going to wake up. Ah, he left his socks on the floor again. Ah, she didn't put that back, and she got ants in the cereal again. And yeah. I told her not to do that, but you make the choice,
right?
I kind of passed it.
Part of me, the thing that really makes the Before trilogy stand out beyond romance is it's also a profound statement on the passage of time, and I feel like Before Sunset looks at it in a very whimsical way, and Before Midnight looks at it in a very I don't want to say profound as if the other two weren't profound, because they both deal with time. Like, you know, Before Sunrise is they only have this amount of time before they have to leave and he has to go back to America. And Before Sunset is very like, we have an hour and 20 minutes to figure this out. They all deal with time. But Before Midnight is the first one. They spend a lot of time. And the reason I wanted to bring up in the pre-episode, the dedication and Linklater finding out about the woman who inspired these movies being killed, unfortunately, in a motorcycle accident, is there's a feeling of, there's a lot of talk about death in this movie. And there's a lot of acknowledging, like, time's impermanence and how, you know, again, one of the most beautiful moments of the film is the woman when she gives her little speech about, you know, we're very important to some, but to others we're just passing through, and they all toast to passing through. And this movie feels very focused on that idea. You know, he talks about his grandfather dying, or his grandmother dying, and he tells his dad, oh, you're an orphan now. And Celine's like, that's not funny. And he's like, yeah, I guess not. But, you know, they talk about that. She talks about how she finds it kind of beautiful to think of all these people frozen in time, buried under lava, molten ash. And Jesse's like, what, you think that's romantic, us being buried under, like, molten ash? And she's like, yeah, but they had kids with them. And he's like, oh, chill. Yeah, we'll all be. But it's like there's kind of this sense throughout the movie that they are becoming more and more aware of their mortality. Like, I think there's an undercurrent here that even more so than Before Sunrise and Before Sunset seems to acknowledge that and seems to kind of meditate on that. And and I think that's part of why a couple people I've talked to have kind of been like, oh, this one is really sad and depressing, because I think more so than the other ones, this one is very focused on like, I don't want to say death. It's not really focused on death, but there is a vibe in the movie that they are very aware of. She tells him when he makes kind of the off color comment about like, hey, dad, you're an orphan now. She's like, that's not funny. You know, he your dad's next and then it's you. And it's kind of like it's funny in the scene. But you think about what she's saying and it's like, damn. And these movies. I mean, it's almost a documentary in a way. You're watching these people. You're watching Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy age and grow as much as you're watching Jesse and Celine. And
yeah.
It's an incredible thing. But it there are times when I go back to Before Midnight where it's like, this is rough. And I'm wondering if you felt that kind of emotional wallop, but more so or how it related to the other two movies.
I will say, you know, just to open up on like a personal relation level with it, is I'm on the backside of, you know, my midlife crisis, I guess you could say, you know, both parents are gone, all of this stuff. And like, I turn around and I look at it. I mean, I'm not that old, but you know, once both parents are gone, you're sort of like, oh, hey, time runs out.
Yeah.
I think that this, I might relate to this more like, because I didn't see them when they were released. Before Sunset is a beautiful thing. I fell in love with it. It's, and, you know, and Before Sunrise as well, because it is that ideal. It's like, oh, I remember back. I remember falling in love like that. I remember wanting to be with somebody like that. But then I do think Before Midnight is the one that you look at and you do say, I've lived this. And I think they even said that in some commentary or interview.
Yeah,
you shared a couple of, you know, videos with me where they were talking about it. But in terms of that, how you relate to time, I think you hit on it when you said, you know, Before Sunrise has to do with we only have this amount of time. And then Before Sunset is we have to figure it out in this amount of time. But then Before Midnight, in a sense, gets back to, expands on, and takes a more mature look at the very idea from the first one of, we only have this much time.
Yeah. In a completely different way. Yeah, on the flip
right.
side. Yeah. No, that's a very good perspective on it. And so when the movie opened, I want to get your feel. I want to kind of experience this through you, because
okay.
I'm so proud you were able to avoid any spoilers. I want to live through you, because I knew they were together. I knew they had kids, and I missed the feeling of what it must have been like to watch the opening of this movie and wondering what's going on. That's his kid, but where's Celine? Where is he? You know, so what was it like? The movie opens, he's with his kid. What are you thinking? Are you wondering where Celine is? What's happening? What's going on? How did that play out, and how did it feel when you saw that they did end up together?
I wasn't surprised. Like, I saw, like, I was a little disoriented, because I figured with the age of that child, I got the sense of, okay, they're at an airport and he's with his son, and it sounds initially like he's sending his son off for a vacation. And then as it goes, you know, the dialogue reveals, he did get divorced.
Yeah.
And he's sending his son home. Okay. And even in that moment where the son has trouble saying goodbye to him, but mainly because he says, don't show up to my recital.
Yeah.
Mom hates you. And you think for a second, because you're so rooting for Jesse and Celine to get together during Before Sunset. It's like, oh, sure, you're married with a kid, but whatever. You guys are soulmates.
Right.
You should be together. And the very first thing they throw at you is, this had a real impact, guys.
Yes. Yeah.
And you immediately feel like, I shouldn't have been cheering for it.
It's weird. Then. It's weird how each one of these movies has kind of shed a new light on its previous film.
Yeah.
Like I said before in our other episodes, it enriches and it deconstructs the previous film in a way that does not ruin. You can still go back and love, like I mean, Sunset is still my favorite. And you can still go back and love these movies without feeling like, oh, but they end up being kind of unhappy and they kind of live a normal, you know, you can still go back and watch and love the movies for what they are. But I just love the way. I remember I had a friend who, I think I told the story in the Before Sunrise episode, so I'll keep it brief. But I had a friend who was, I was telling her about Before Sunrise, and she's like, I can't believe that this movie is real. Because every movie, the couple ends up together, they're happy, and that's not real. That's not real life. And I'm like, well, you've got to see these movies. And this was only Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. Before Midnight hadn't even come out yet. So I was like, well, you've got to see these movies, because Before Sunset is such an honest kind of reflection on Before Sunrise. But then to a whole other level, Before Midnight comes out, and it's like, yep, there are consequences. It's not just, you know, oh, we got together, everything was okay. It's, I am now suffering because I have this amazing son who I feel like I've abandoned him. And what do I do? And it's, oh, it's so good. And I mean, they build it in that first scene with them together. And so the shot of them in the car, there's a cutaway shot of the ruins where it's like, oh, do we want to go to the ruins? And I always thought like, oh, they probably cut away because they had to break for the takes. Apparently, that's just a cutaway. And they actually did one continuous shot of them in the car for that whole time. That whole conversation was a continuous shot.
But that actually, that comes in later too, when they're walking to the hotel and they're talking. And this is really what makes it feel so loose and real, is those cutaway moments. But even better is when they're walking to the hotel and they're talking, and then Celine just goes, goats.
Yeah.
And you look over, and it's like, that's what you do.
I know.
When you're like walking along, it's like, oh, hey, goats.
I love that. I love that. Because again, it's in Before Sunset, they were so focused on each other. And so like, we have to make this happen, and something has to happen, that you kind of miss the leisurely vibe of Before Sunrise. And they were like, oh, it's so beautiful here. Look at this. Look at that. Before Midnight, it recaptures. It's like the complete flip side of the coin of Before Sunrise, where it's like before sunrise they're young and optimistic and happy, and before midnight they still love each other, but it's a more mature thing, and it's taken some beatings, but they're still going through and like, oh, there's a dog on this roof here. Let's stop into this church and look at this, and they have stories, and they're still willing to take their time. And They take the time to like another one of my favorite moments when they're watching the sunset together. Mm-hmm. And oh God, this movie has so many moments that are just like, yeah, they get you. And I don't know if anything is more impressive in this movie. So they keep planting throughout the movie, you know, his son, Jesse's son, Hank. It's a major sore spot for him. And right from the get-go, it's almost a bit more conventional than Sunset and Sunrise, because this is the first one where they kind of, you could argue there's more of a strong three-act structure where you plant the idea at the beginning, this is the problem, Hank, I want my son Hank, I miss him, I think we should move to America, and she's like, I don't want to do that, I don't know how I feel about it, and it builds and builds and builds, kind of disappears for a little bit, we get the nice walk and talk moments. And again, I love that we do get the moments of them just kind of walking and talking in Greece. And she kind of points it out. She's like, this is so weird. We haven't just done like this in such a long time.
Right. Right. And that is exactly, you know, another one of the points is like, that's what makes relationships so difficult sometimes, is that, you know, as everything accumulates in your life, you know, I mean, I have three kids. One of them's 2 years old. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like every so often, you know, we will get a moment together, and it's like, wow, okay. You know, and
you
like,
remember
actually,
why? Yeah, you remember what it is.
Oh, yeah,
about,
right. That's like, how I like you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
So I love, and even in the context of the film, because the film does, I don't think it ends on a pessimistic note. It's not a depressing film, but it for about 30 to 40 minutes, you are in the thick of it with them, and there's no one pulls any punches, and you're like, oh, man. So it's nice to look back on the film and remember we have moments like the car ride, or like the moment when they're riding through Greece, because we get to the point where finally, and it's so, I am always in wonder, like I just am amazed how natural it is and how it feels so real. But they have their love scene, what looks to be like the first love scene in this trilogy.
Yeah.
And very naturally and very sinisterly, it turns into this horrific argument. And the how that switch and the transition is, I watch it because I'm like, I know it's coming, and I just watch it, and I am never not in awe of how real it feels and how sincere it feels.
And that is, I was initially uncomfortable with that because I do in fact feel so close to these characters that when the love scene started up, it was one of those things where I was like, oh no, I want to give you guys some privacy.
I know.
I wanted to leave the room to be like, oh no, you guys.
It was a weird moment where I was like, should we leave? Right. I was like, Richard Linklater, we don't need to see this in real time. I'm okay. I understand. It's okay. I will give you the pass. It's all right. But no, it was kind of like weird. It's like, oh my gosh. All right. Well, you know, it was that weird moment of like, I guess I'm happy for them, but this is very much more intimate than they've ever been before that we've seen on screen.
But you use the word horrific when it goes into this horrific fight. And it's funny because you say that and I immediately think horror movie. And this is how a horror movie, dresses you down so that you don't, so that you're ready for the horrible moment, actually.
Mm.
Like everybody talks about, oh, well, the sex scenes are punished. No. You're always attacked by the killer in a horror movie when you are your most vulnerable.
Right.
When are you vulnerable? When you're naked, when you're paying attention to something sexual, or when you're showering or asleep. Like those are the four times. Killer's holiday right there.
It's true. So Before Midnight is, you're saying it's a horror movie.
Yes. Yes, it is in fact a horror movie.
I think there is. Yes. I think some critics did call it. Like they were like, this movie has a scene scarier than anything I've seen in any horror movie.
but that's the thing, is it dresses you down. It takes down your barriers where you're like, oh, I'm going to see something really intimate. What's happening? No. Oh, no. No, no, no. Stop. You know, like,
Get out of the room.
Stop talking, Jesse.
It's the flip. It's almost like you're expecting one kind of intimacy and you get another kind of intimacy. And you're like, oh, you know what? I changed my mind. You can go back to the other one. I'm okay with it. But Richard Linklater has always said he saw the hotel scene as a love scene. He's like, I don't see it as a fight. I see it as I was thinking of it in my mind. This is a love scene between two characters that are clearly in love with each other but are struggling. And I just want to talk about the hotel scene. We've got 40 minutes of I don't know if it's actually 40 minutes. I want to say it's 30 to 40 minutes of real, this is the climax of the film. It's the two of them just going at it. Like it is it's like everything that they've been kind of, it's been creeping out and you've been kind of sensing the conflict and you've been sensing the pressure and it's been building and building. They take little jabs at each other throughout the movie around other people. And now it's almost worse in a way because these are two people who have given themselves so fully to each other and been so open to each other. So they know exactly how to hurt each other. And it makes it so much more painful to watch it happen.
And again, that's exactly how it is in real life, man.
Yeah. There are a couple. I mean, it's funny. It's like simultaneously hilarious and simultaneously. It's like laughing at a joke you know you're not supposed to laugh at. It's like, oh, no. Like there's the nurturer when she's like, the woman is the nurturer. And he's like, the what? The nurturer. And she's like, I can't even say that word, but the yes. And he keeps he just keeps making these comments. And she is, I'm going to have to bleep this, but when she's like, I can't, the only time I get to think is when I'm taking a shit at the office. So I've started to associate thoughts with the smell of shit. And he's like, and he's in the bathroom, like, I'm going to tune up a screen section. Could you just give me a second, please? And watching them go at it is, oh my God. But then it gets like, it gets nasty, and especially the moment for me that is really like, it's like, talk about like ruining the high of that Before Sunset ending when she sings him the song, when he goes, he's like, you know, I love the way you sing. You're a great singer. I f***ed up my whole life because of the way you sing. And it was like, oh, God.
Yeah.
It hurts so much, but it's like, what about that scene? Are there moments in that scene that particularly stood out to you as like, oh, that's fantastic, or oh, that's hilarious, or oh, that was painful? Was there like, what was the, because you talk about how you're like, no, 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 no. What was the moment where you were like, no, stop it?
I would have to say that one of the point at which I knew it was really gonna ramp up and not ever go back to the sexual intimacy was during when he goes to flop on the couch, he corrects her grammar again.
She goes, now I know why Sylvia Plath stuck her head in a toaster. It was an oven.
Oh, that's right. It wasn't grammar, but yeah, he's like, it wasn't. but it's that sort of thing where there are little moments where fine. Oh, no, this is, okay, Dr. Phil. There are moments I can recognize myself in Jesse. And something like that is exactly what I would do during an argument. I wouldn't just say, mentally you're like, I know what she means. I'll correct her later. It doesn't matter. Right. But then there's that other part of you that's just, you've had enough and you're fed up and you're just like, you know what? It's not a toaster.
Right. Okay?
It was an oven. You're just so ramped up for it. You're ready to just throw whatever haymaker you can find in your arsenal just to try to have the fight over with.
Sure. There's so many moments where like I love it because the dynamics of it are so real, but like he thinks he's getting the advantage and he's like, okay, we're calm. Everything's okay. And he'll make some comment that she'll take the wrong way. And all of a sudden it's like, boom, back to 100. And she's freaking out. She's like insulting his sex drive and his writing and all that stuff. And one of the tough things for me is, I'm a guy, and one of the things I love about these movies is how honestly they've depicted both sides of the gender. But it's almost like it invites you to pick a side in the fight to say, like, all right, we're going to draw the line here. But I always, there were a couple people who were like, oh, what's wrong with Celine? She's very, like, mean in this movie. And I've had to talk to a couple people who have said that. And I've said, well, what is it about it? And it's interesting because Celine, I will agree, Celine is picking on him throughout the whole movie. Almost every interaction they have, she picks on him in some way, like where she's like making fun of him or being condescending, or like at the dinner scene where she kind of like mocks his, like, oh, he wants to go to Chicago to be with his son, and he's getting very like, no, I didn't say that, I thought we were trying to have a conversation. But she does jab at him throughout the movie. But you also have to remember Jesse, you see it. You see Jesse getting to hang out with his friends. Oh, we get to talk about, my new novel, about these great ideas I have. And she's making dinner for them. She's making food.
And she's doing the work.
She's doing all the work. And he gets away with like chill, being the chill, cool guy. And she calls him out for it. And she has every right to be pissed off at him. When she like tells him, like, I take care of you. You take care of you. I take care of you and everybody else. Like, it's not.
Yes.
It's not petty. And as petty as their fight gets, and as much as he tries to be like, oh, let's be rational and let's do this. I just remember wincing because I was like, oh, God, how many times have I said that to a girlfriend? Like, let's be rational. And then she drops one of the best one-liners ever, which is the world it's gone to shit because of rational men deciding things. Like that's paraphrasing it, but I love that line so much.
Yeah. Once or twice I may have been guilty of saying, get your ass together, and it happens. And that's the power of this film is I cannot agree with the idea that Celine is nasty or mean in any way. Celine is somebody who is at a breaking point, and Jesse is the one who doesn't see it.
Right.
Jesse keeps pushing her. Now, does he realize he's pushing her? No. Jesse is so caught up in himself, though, that you see how his own inattentiveness to what's going on keeps pushing her, keeps driving her toward anger. And if he just demonstrates a little awareness outside of self a couple of times earlier in the film, the fight's probably not as nasty. The fight's probably a little spat, and they talk about things, and that's the setup, is they're supposed to be having their night. But then, of course, all of her, she makes her sexual digs at him. He's always got sex on his mind. and you're like, oh, come on, you're being unfair to him. And what's the thing? They walk in the hotel room, and the first thing he does is he goes for sex.
Mm.
He doesn't try to just keep talking to her.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to sit there and drink the wine and eat the cheese and take his time. He just wants to get to what he wants. And that, I think, is, this is sort of just an elongated response, I guess, to the idea that anybody would think that Celine's being nasty. I don't think she's being nasty. I think that Celine, in a sense, in this fight, is, you know, asking for him to please just think outside of himself.
Mm. It's true.
And he does.
Yeah.
At the end, he does. He realizes. And that's why I think it's so beautiful in their final conversation when he has the made up letter and they're talking and he says, you know, I'm that guy. I'm that guy you fell in love with.
Mm.
And it's so true. No matter what else has come between them, no matter what else is built up, if it's a matter of getting back to that and remembering that's the person I fell in love with.
Right.
Then there's your anchor. Go back to that point and then work forward again and then find out what broke along the way.
Yeah. And you see that in that moment. You see her, she's resistant, but she meets him halfway. And this has come at the tail end of a very like nasty, brutal and forthcoming argument and fight where you get the sense, I don't want the trilogy to end here. I don't want it to stop just because I love these people so much. I think it should keep going. But at the same time, there is a cyclical element to it. Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy, and Richard Linklater have all commented on how the movie Before Sunrise opens with the couple on the train fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. And now Jesse and Celine have become that couple. But I think the difference is there is a, as has always been the case in their lives and why they've always been so special, is there's also a need to communicate themselves. Instead of a you're a lost cause, it's a let's try to work through this. Let's try to understand where we're coming from. And even though they keep missing each other, they keep throwing punches at each other, they still come out of it, you hope, stronger than they were before. You know, and I want to ask you, because Linklater, everyone's been like, oh my God, I think, you know, you think they broke up. And Linklater's like, I don't think so at all. I don't think that is, he said, you know, I think you can look at it as, if you want to, if you've been through something like that and it's ended your relationship, fine. You can see that and that's there. But on the flip side, you may have been through that part of a relationship and you may have emerged on the other end stronger. So he's like, I don't think there's a definitive answer either way. But at the same time, do you get the vibe that this could be a conclusion? Would it be a good conclusion?
I would be fine with them not making another one, in the sense that you're right, it is cyclical, you know, and those sorts of things. But at the same time, I don't know, is it possibly, and this is something I say that I'm sure I cribbed from somewhere or whatever, but like this is the type of ending, I think, type of film. And a lot of times there are films as a whole, there's a Rorschach test element to it. How do you read this? I come at it and I hear somebody say, oh, well, they obviously break up after this. And I look at them and I say, what? No, they're starting to put things back together in the last minute there.
Right.
And I think that also speaks to, we're used to that definitive ending. And none of these films has had a definitive ending.
Because life does not have a definitive ending except for death. You are always going. It's not like all right, now. And again, that's why I love about these movies. It's Before Sunrise, we had the perfect moment. These two people met. They might never see each other again. Or they'll see each other in 6 months. Before Sunset, they didn't, and their lives aren't great, but they still have each other. And maybe they'll get together. And then, you know, go forward another 9 years. And it's, they got together. Their lives are a little tough right now. They're going through a rough patch, but they're working on it. And it's, you know, like you said, it's never, there's no conclusion. And I said this, I think, in the Sunset episode we did, but I love the thought that Jesse and Celine are out there somewhere. That,
yes,
I can only hope in 4 years, because we're now at year five, I can only hope in 4 years they will come back and we'll get to kind of check in on them and see how they're doing.
I would love that. I would love that. I would be there on opening day, and I'd even buy my tickets ahead of time on Fandango or whatever service. Yeah. But I think that really what I mean, like, there's a testament to Linklater as a director, or to you know, to the cinema, all of these different sorts of things. But I think more than anything else, what is so trippy, what is so wild, what is so weird to me is there's no point at which I can't separate Ethan Hawke from Jesse or Julie Delpy from Celine.
Right.
But when I'm experiencing this, they are real. You know, you said you like to believe that they're out there somewhere. If I met Ethan Hawke, I don't know how I would relate to him. I don't know if I could. I don't think I ever want to see him as a real person in front of me, because,
right,
or Julie Delpy, because, like, they do exist. And I think that, and I think I said this in the previous, at least one of the previous episodes, what a testament to them as actors that they can make these characters live. And it's so strange as well, because of the fact that I think that these are the types of films that I would want to show to other friends of mine who, like me, are big science fiction fans and action fans and Bond fans and all of those types of things. And it's okay to look at this and say, I will never get anything like this in my franchise of choice.
Yeah.
This is not going to happen. This is a whole different level and type of filmmaking, and no matter how much I tell myself that, you know, Captain America the Winter Soldier is an amazing comic book movie, it's not Jesse and Celine.
Yeah.
And no matter how much I tell myself that, you know, oh my gosh, I love Star Trek 2, well, okay, Star Trek 2 is that's a bad example.
whoa, John. Whoa.
Yeah, I don't want to go off the rails.
Let's not say
that,
anything we're going to regret here.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, it is extremely rare, and I think one of the highest compliments I can give, because the thing is, I'm sitting here praising them as actors, but it's such a tremendous compliment to Linklater as a filmmaker to know how to make that happen and how to use the camera in such a way that it never breaks that for me. And to know how to get things to flow and move along. And the highest compliment I could possibly pay him is that in terms of the performances and the believability of the characters that he gets, he reminds me of the best work, you know, if we're going to a different genre, the best work of Michael Mann for the big epic, you know, action spectacles, because you believe in Daniel Day-Lewis as Hawkeye in Last of the Mohicans and Madeline Stowe. Like, you believe in you know that they're not real, but you know that they are.
Right.
And so it's one of those things where it's such a rare treat and accomplishment to find a combination like that. And another thing that I love is with, you know, all of, you know, the behind the scenes stuff, is you see such an intense respect and love between the three of them as collaborators, that is a collaborative group that's a literally once in a generation type of collaboration that's going on right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing.
Yeah. And it's incredible, because at the end of all this, I don't think Linklater can resist. I don't think Ethan Hawke or Julie Delpy can resist.
No.
Like, you can't just say it's going to be three films and we're done. Life isn't just three films and we're done. You know, it's like,
right.
I don't think you can resist if their hearts are still in it and they feel like they have something to say every 9 years, they can keep going and going. And they can, this can be, I feel like it's already defined their careers, all three of them,
but yeah.
it can be, even more than it already is, a defining moment in cinema. And this is, I have a quote from Ethan Hawke. This is an interview he did with IndieWire at the end of 2016. They were asking him, you know, what's going on? Are they coming back? And Ethan Hawke says, I would have said after the second, there was definitely going to be a third one, but I do feel complete in that the first one starts with the older couple arguing on the train. And by the end of the third one, we've become that couple. if it were to continue, it would change shape. It would be something else. Julie, Rick, and I might work together again. We might revisit those characters, but it'll need a new burst of energy. I don't know what it is. We're not allowed to think about it until 5 years after. That's how we've done it every time. Waking Life was 5 years after Before Sunrise. Before Midnight, we met 5 years after Before Sunset. So we're going to meet 5 years after the release of Before Midnight, talk about it, and see where we wind up. 2018 is the five-year mark. So, I mean, I think this is, I mean, if anything, I hope this Missing Frames episode is going to push them over the edge to say, yes, it's got to happen. But I feel like you can't, like, it's like, you know, yeah. I can't imagine they would ever want, I don't want them to do it if they feel like they're forcing it, but I feel like, right. Oh, guys, there's always going to be something to say.
I agree. I agree. I'll be happy with whatever they choose. I think to have, because I actually resisted giving my rating, my final rating on Letterboxd, because I didn't want to tip my hand to you. But I think having a trilogy of 3 5-star movies in a row.
Yeah.
You know, there's an argument for going out on top and just being like, I'm cool. Seriously, it's, we're not dealing with, you know, the Fast and Furious franchise or Disney's Star Wars cash machine or anything like that. This is not something where, you know, I'll just steal your sentiment. Do it if you find a reason, but do not do it if you feel obligated. I don't want you guys to feel obligated at all, because the statement that you've made is absolutely gorgeous. And I've teased you about this, repeatedly, but you made me a Bond fan and now you've made me a Linklater fan. And, I can honestly say, especially in terms of the Linklater stuff, I am all the better for it, because I don't know how I went as long as I did without experiencing these films. And I'm so glad that I have. And I look forward to experiencing them again and again going forward. And it's just absolutely gorgeous.
Well, that means a lot to me. And I mean, as I said in the pre-show, I'm a little sad that this is like, we may be done with these. We're not done with these movies ever. We'll always revisit them. But that, you know, we don't get to see them for the first time again. I can only hope. One of the big things I hope is that they make another one, because I don't care where you are. I don't care where I am. I will find a way to come hang out with you and we'll go see it together. Yes. We'll make it happen. And if Missing Frames is still around, that's going to happen. And that's amazing. Yes. It's like these movies are time capsules. Like 2013 is already 5 years gone. And I can remember as if it were yesterday going to New York to see this movie. And I just love that in 4 years' time, we could be seeing the next one, the next movie, and just thinking about, like, man, remember when we got to sit down and talk about those movies and see them together? That's what these movies, in a weird way, I feel like that's the feeling these movies celebrate, is being able to share these things and being able to, through the years, continue to share these things with each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's that. And then, as arbitrary as it is there any way you can rank it as far as if you were to rank the trilogy from favorite to least favorite, can you do it, or is it just too difficult at this point?
I think I'm going to issue myself the delicious challenge to rewatch the trilogy at some point in the future, and I'll get back to you on it.
And there's a great documentary, I don't know if you watched it, on the Before Midnight Blu-ray. Of it's 30 minutes of them kind of rehearsing. They just wrapped production, so it's like footage of them right after wrapping production with footage of them rehearsing and filming, and it's an absolute delight. I just watched it.
I will watch it. I was specifically staying away from even the written word that's on the packaging. Like, I wouldn't even let myself see what they wrote about it or what critics thought about it. Seriously, I just went complete completely dark on this, and now I'll go back, and this is in fact a set that I will go back and I will watch all of the supplementals, because usually I'm not nuts about the supplementals for things, like it's a very catch as catch can sort of thing. But this I'm going to consume all of that data and just bring it in.
I'd encourage it, and I guess that's that. I mean, this has been absolutely one of the great joys of my life, sharing these movies with you, and I can't thank you enough. I'm so glad we got to do this. 1 year after watching the first one, we've seen all three.
It's amazing, man. I'm so happy to have gone on this journey. Thank you.
Thank you. And we hope everyone listening has enjoyed this. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out the rest of the shows on the Nerd Party. You may like what you hear there, too. There's all sorts of great stuff. And you can, again, follow us on Twitter at Joy Nerd Party. You can like the Facebook page, The Nerd Party. And you can chat with me at YeSeanDoorman on Twitter. I would, again, I can't stress it enough. I would love talking about these movies. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Anyone who loves these movies is a friend of mine, I feel like. So please, if you want to talk about it, feel free to reach out with me or reach out to me. John, where can people reach out to you?
I'm Castle Junkie. I'm here on the network. I'm on Aggressive Negotiations with Matt Rushing. I'm on Great Shot Kid with Mike Schindler. And I'm on Words with Nerds with my pal Craig.
There you go. So I can only hope in 4 years' time we will be reuniting again to discuss After Dawn? After midday?
Before brunch.
Before brunch.
Before brunch.
After afternoon. But it's two words. After noon. We're getting
like
real
this.
Philosophical.
Ooh, a second
now.
Trilogy starts.
There it is.
Before, 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 after, after, after.
I think this is, they're going to need to pay us for this. Chiaro mandi che sfigure sparlo.